welcome to this reading of the Business Record, which is Central Iowa's Business Weekly. I'm Pat Steele. All material heard on IRIS is intended for the use of listeners with print disabilities. Now, here's our first story from the March 22nd edition of the Business Record. Seven finalists have been chosen for the Black and Brown Business Summit pitch competition, and Summit's keynote speakers also have been announced. This is a story written by the Business Record staff. The West Des Moines Chamber of Commerce has announced that seven finalists for the 2024 pitch competition at the 4th Annual Athene Black and Brown Business Summit. An eighth finalist will be randomly selected on the day of the event on April 18th. The finalist was chosen from a pool of more than 100 applicants from across the United States. According to a news release, the pitch purse currently stands at $50,000 this year. The amount will be divided among the eight finalists, and judges will determine how the prize is distributed. For more information and tickets, you can visit the West Des Moines Chamber's website. The seven finalists are Abig Tea Shop of Des Moines, Detox LLC of Portland, Oregon, Femley of Baltimore, Flick Shop of Washington, D.C., Four Corners Coalition of Waterloo, Fresh Mediterranean Express in Waukee, and Lightly of North Hollywood, California. The West Des Moines Chamber has also announced two keynote speakers for the summit. They are Hill Harper, an entrepreneur, activist, author, and actor, and Tiffany Pham, an entrepreneur, author, and TV personality. Harper owns the roasting plant in Detroit and co-owns businesses in New Orleans. He also served with President's Cancer Panel under former President Barack Obama. Pham is the founder and CEO of Mogul, a diversity recruitment company. She also serves on the AI Governance Alliance for the World Economic Forum. The West Des Moines Chamber introduces Civic Connect to enhance business advocacy. The West Des Moines Chamber of Commerce has announced the introduction of its new Government Affairs Committee, Civic Connect. The nonpartisan committee aims to foster education, engagement, and encouragement among its members, according to a news release. The West Des Moines Chamber will host its next Civic Connect event, which will feature Iowa Representative David Young, a Republican, at 2 p.m. on March 22nd at the chamber's office. Seating is limited. For those interested in attending, you can visit the link on the West Des Moines Chamber of Commerce site. Can't Grow Old Without Her reports highlights women's role in elder care. This is an article written by Business Record staff. Women leave the workforce at a higher rate than men to provide care to the country's aging population, according to a new report from Wells Fargo. This phenomenon puts a strain on labor force growth and negatively contributes to women's lifetime earnings. Sharon Grine, a macroeconomist at Wells Fargo and one of the authors of this study, told the Business Record, "The direct challenge of an aging demographic is obviously that there's less of a working age population. The indirect challenge is that as we have more and more of the population growing older, these people require care that could drive more working people out of the labor market, particularly women." The report, published in recognition of Women's History Month, highlights the role that women play in providing both unpaid and paid elder care. A few key takeaways are these. Number one is in the case for child care, women take on the majority of unpaid elder care. Elder care needs in the United States have never been greater. The U.S. Census Bureau projects an additional 1.7 million seniors will need care within the next decade. Despite the increasing need, the cost of care remains prohibitively expensive for many families who instead opt to take on the responsibilities themselves. Researchers found that women accounted for 59% of unpaid caregivers for older family members, performing nearly 4 hours a day of unpaid care between 2021 and 2022. The value of this labor is worth roughly $113 billion, according to the report. Grine said, "The responsibility of child care tends to fall disproportionately on women, but there is this other responsibility that hits them later in life, and that is elder care. Whether it's parents or loved ones, it just primarily falls on women more than men." The second takeaway, women over 55 take on more unpaid and paid care. women ages 55 and up take on a disproportionate amount of elder care, something that came as a surprise to researchers. This group represented 28% of all unpaid elder care providers in 2021-2022, compared with only 18% of men in the same age group, according to the report. When you're in your 30s or maybe younger, you might have to step out for child care, Grind said. Then, in your mid to late 50s, you might step out for elder care. Women are really getting hit on both ends of their age spectrum. Women ages 55 and up are also more likely to take on paid elder care, making up 27% of the workforce in healthcare support positions. That's roughly 2.5 times more than their share in the labor force as a whole, and nearly 10 times above the share of men in the same jobs. While the United States Department of Labor projects that job growth in healthcare support will increase by 22% in the next decade, the report highlights that these jobs typically pay less compared with the traditionally female-dominated jobs older women would have. Third takeaway, the burden of unpaid care limits women's earnings and businesses' ability to hire. Despite an increasing number of paid opportunities, the demands on women to provide unpaid elder care hinders their ability to take advantage of them. Nearly 2 million women over the age of 55 had to leave the labor force due to family obligations in 2023, which is 7 times the number of men in the same group. If you're working less in general, you have less capacity to save, and that also dents your Social Security income once you retire, Grind said. It dents the financial position of half the population. According to the report, when a woman leaves the workforce, her earnings take a hit. For many families, that means the next time a family member needs care, the person making less money, typically a woman, will step out of the workforce again. This cycle strong-arms women into career breaks or into entering into lower-paid positions because they tend to offer more flexibility, Grind said. Women's disproportionate role in elder care has gotten less attention than other challenges to women's labor force participation, according to Grind. But there are ways employers can help ease these burdens. Grind said, in a time when labor is likely going to be in short supply because of the aging dynamics, if you're able to offer flexibility, you might have a leg up. Anything you can do to differentiate yourself can attract workers. The University of Northern Iowa is going to host the inaugural Des Moines Real Estate Alumni Reception and Award Introduction. You and I will connect and honor Des Moines real estate professionals and alumni during the first annual You and I Real Estate Alumni Reception Award presentation hosted at DMAC Urban Campus from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. on April 11th in Building 7. The event will also announce the creation of the Arthur T. Cox Real Estate Champion Award, honoring the longtime director of the UNI Center for Real Estate Education. The first recipient will be selected in 2025. I'm so excited to see how strong the connections are in this industry and especially in the Des Moines area, Brett Olson, head of the finance department, which oversees the real estate program, said in a prepared statement. Elsewhere in this week's business record, Baton Global, a Des Moines-based strategy and consulting firm, announced that Matthew Mitchell, a founding partner company, will serve as CEO. Founded in 2014, Baton Global has grown to serve Fortune 500 insurance and financial services companies, government agencies, and nonprofit organizations in Iowa and globally. The firm offers services in strategy, leadership, innovation, and research. The firm has contributed several Central Iowa projects, including the Capital Crossroads Map, the DSM Forward Playbooks, and Envision Iowa, an initiative created by Business Record parent company Business Publications Incorporated. Baton's managing director and partner, Wade Britt, said in a prepared statement, "As one of our founding partners, Matthew has led the company through periods of significant growth and innovation. Going forward, his technical background and global experience will help clients prepare for the impact of AI on their workforce and operating model." Mitchell holds degrees in physics and math, as well as an MBA from Rollins College. He earned his doctorate in international business from the University of South Carolina. He also serves as a faculty member at Drake University's Zimpelman College of Business, where he teaches strategy in international business. And in a weekly column by the Business Record regarding real estate development in Central Iowa, the headline for this week's column is Freight Company Buys Undeveloped Land in Ankeny. Kathy Bolton is the author of this article. Old Dominion's Freight Line and National Trucking Company paid Beasley Farms Incorporated $1.65 million for 19 acres of undeveloped property in Ankeny. Old Dominion, which is based in Thomasville, North Carolina, operates a warehouse at 6925 Southeast 4 Mile Drive. The property the company acquired is southwest of its facility, and the transaction was recorded on March 11. D.R. Horton, Iowa, LLC, a national home builder, paid Stubbs Development Incorporated just over $1 million for 14 residential building lots in Ankeny. Canyon Landing is in northeast Ankeny, east of Northeast 38th Street. That transaction was recorded on March 13. Ernest and Ann Odell, both of Redondo Beach, California, paid a Springfield, Missouri-based limited liability company nearly $1.3 million for property on Brown Street in Reynolds. The two-acre parcel includes a 9,100-square-foot metal building in which a Dollar General is located. The building was constructed in 2023. The limited liability company that had owned the property will lease the property, records show. The transaction was recorded on March 14. Lincoln Savings Bank took possession of property at 121st Street in Urbandale after a sheriff's sale. The nearly three-acre parcel includes 22,463-square-foot neighborhood shopping center built in 26. According to court records, foreclosure proceedings on a property which had been owned by AGM Properties started last week. The property's previous owner owed the bank over $2.5 million plus interest and fees. Lincoln Savings Bank acquired the property for $2.2 million. In Dallas County, the Curtis and Cynthia Wilson Family Revocable Trust paid KRM Development just over $1 million for property in Urbandale, Dallas County real estate records show. The property includes a 1,887-square-foot house that was recently built. That transaction was recorded on March 14. And finally, Ronald and Deborah Gebhardt paid Ballsmore Farms $3.48 million for 51.5 acres of farm ground in rural Dallas County. The land is about 7 miles southwest of Perry, or on the west side of F Avenue and south of 180th Street. That transaction was recorded on March 14. Heard considers options for newly acquired property at high-profile West Des Moines intersection. This is an article written by Kathy Bolton, staff writer for the Business Record. Real estate developer Richard Heard's resume includes sparking redevelopment areas others shied away from. Around 2009, Heard acquired property in the 1200 block of 8th Street at West Des Moines that had been home to a Ford dealership. The property was redeveloped to include a strip shopping center and come-and-go convenience store. New development is now occurring south of the properties. In 2013, Heard bought properties in the 200 and 300 blocks of Grand Avenue in West Des Moines. Tired-looking buildings that had housed fast food restaurants were razed, and a Hy-Vee Fast and Fresh was built on the site. In recent years, new construction area has included a Wendy's restaurant and retail store for Eric's Bike Shop. Heard has also redeveloped properties along Ingersoll Avenue and renovated the former Dow Jones building at 4125 Westtown Parkway in West Des Moines. Now Heard has his sites on the northwest corner of Valley West Drive and Westtown Parkway. In early March, he bought property at 3501 Westtown Parkway that had been home to Iowa Realty Company's corporate and commercial offices. In 2021, the real estate company consolidated its West Des Moines offices to one location, and that's located at 5901 Mills Civic Parkway in West Des Moines. The Westtown Parkway property is located in an area ripe for redevelopment, said Heard, founder and president of West Des Moines-based Heard Real Estate. Over the years, we've bought a lot of properties and we've turned them around either by rehabbing or redeveloping them, he said. We hope to do the same here. Hurd has not yet made plans for the 2-acre Westtown Parkway parcel that includes a one-story, 11,180-foot square foot office building that was built in 1970. Sometimes buildings are worthy of being repositioned, and sometimes it may make sense to just start over, Hurd said. I don't know the answer yet. What Hurd does know is that the area, which is anchored by a struggling Valley West Mall, remains of interest to retailers. The Valley West Drive and Westtown Parkway intersection is less than 600 feet from the exit ramp of the heavily traveled Interstate Highway 235. Several big-name retailers, including Hy-Vee, Target, Kohl's, and Office Depot, are within a mile of the intersection. In addition, the area east of Valley West Drive and south of Westtown Parkway is being redeveloped. Construction of a new headquarters for West Bank at 3330 Westtown Parkway is nearing completion. In August 2021, ClaimDoc moved into renovated space at 3448 Westtown Parkway. A dilapidated hotel has been razed that was to the west of Hurd's Westtown Parkway property. Hurd said, my hope is that with the new West Bank building, and hopefully with us getting something going, that will start a trend to redevelop the whole area. There are still a number of retailers interested in that area. The city has a program in place to assist with redevelopment, so we'll see what happens. Hurd acquired the property at 3501 Westtown Parkway for $2 million, and the property is valued at just over $2 million. And we now turn to the opinion section of the Business Record, and our opinion piece this week is written by David Albert. He's the author of The Albert Files, and the headlines is A Recipe for Disaster. My friend KC was admiring artist Richard Serra's five-plate pentagon in the southeast corner of the John and Mary Papajohn Sculpture Park. As I approached, he mumbled something about the legislature needing to grow up. That's a curious comment, I said. Does it have anything to do with the fact that Republican lawmakers are out of their lane again, wanting to ban books, tell schools how to teach history, and make singing the national anthem mandatory? That's what they do in fascist countries, he replied. I find it ironic, he continued, that most lawmakers who want to dictate school curriculums couldn't pass a simple civics test. They don't understand the concept of separation of powers. They want to micromanage cities and schools and public libraries while they ignore real problems like homelessness, hunger, and nursing homes. Don't forget that our healthcare system is falling apart, I added. You see it particularly in rural Iowa, but it's becoming more of an urban problem as fewer doctors want to practice in Iowa when they can make more money elsewhere. KC said, we have one of the worst cancer rates in the country, but state officials don't want to know if there's a connection between cancer and all the agricultural runoff that fouls our water, so they blame it on binge drinking. The sculpture, he said, changing the subject, is called Five Plate Pentagon. It's five steel plates standing on edge at different angles like playing cards and welded together in the center. I've wondered for years what it means tucked away here in a corner of the sculpture park. Today it occurred to me, it's a response to the narrow view of history lawmakers want to teach. I'm not sure I follow, I said. Maybe this will help, KC said. Think of each plate as a tablet, and on each tablet is a different version of history. This one, he said, touching a steel plate, is a version written by our founders, you know, Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, those guys. It's the one Republicans want to teach. This one, he continued, pointing to a different plate, is a version written by descendants of slaves brought over from Africa. He touched the third plate and said, this was written by survivors of the Holocaust, this one by immigrants from Vietnam, Cambodia, and Thailand, and this one by indigenous people. In fact, he continued, there are as many versions of history as there are nations, maybe more given that nations come and go depending on who's in power. If you study all of those histories, you will see that no two are the same, but that there is some truth in all of them. Exposing children to all of them teaches them to think and make connections. You need all the plates to get the full picture. One plate standing on its own isn't much to look at, but five standing at different angles and welded together are a piece of art. He said, Republicans in the Iowa legislature want to limit us to one version of history. And while that might sound appealing, it will stunt growth. Ultimately, it's a recipe for disaster. Besides, Casey said, these guys, Iowa's lawmakers, can't even run their own show. According to their own rules, they were supposed to set Iowa's school aid formula by February 9th so that local school districts know how much money they will have and can send their budgets to the state by March 15th. Last time I checked, they still hadn't set the school aid formula, Casey said. And again, this is an opinion column written by David Albert. He's a columnist for the Business Record. New at-large city council person is elected in Des Moines. Mike Simonson won a special election Tuesday for the at-large Des Moines City Council seat formerly held by Mayor Connie Bozen, according to unofficial results from the Polk County Auditor's Office. The results show that Simonson received 58% of the votes, followed by candidate Justin Lewis, who received 33% of votes. Unofficial numbers show that 7,317 voters, or about 5.7% turnout, turned out to vote, according to the Des Moines Register. Simonson is president of Simonson Associates Architects in Des Moines and graduated from Iowa State University. A developer has mixed-use plans for a business park in Gilbert. Luke Jensen wants to create space that people want to be at. This is a story written by Michael Crum, a staff writer for the Business Record. A local real estate developer is planning a mixed-use development in his hometown of Gilbert, with construction possibly beginning as early as this fall. The business park will complement the growth in residential development the small community has seen in recent years, said Luke Jensen, the managing director of RES Development, one of the partners on the project. Jensen said he purchased the 10 acres of land for about $300,000 from Ben Durbin. The site sits north of Gilbert High School and south of the middle school, and Jensen, a Gilbert High School alum, said he hopes to create a mixed-use development that could include retail, commercial, service, and light industrial. There's been some interest in it, and I've had inquiries from people from a fitness and health background to a counseling background and a little retail, Jensen said. The developer has not determined the total expected investment in the project. Jensen said investment totals will depend on what type of development occurs. The site would be developed into five or six individual lots ranging in size from 1 to 3 acres. They could be developed into either a standalone business or a multi-tenant building like a strip center, he said. Plans also include the extension of Steel Street on the site's western edge. The venture being developed by RES Properties and Gilbert LTD is a partnership among Jensen, his uncle Dave Jensen, and Tim Day, a Gilbert resident. You have three people that care about the area and the city and want to have some vibrancy in the commercial area, Luke Jensen said. Some of the lots could contain speculative buildings, while others could be built to suit for specific businesses. There could also be a mix of selling lots to businesses to self-develop or building and leasing space to tenants, according to Jensen. He added, we're pretty open, but we do have some development standards and expectations for the property owners from the look and feel of the development, and we're vetting some of the inquiries on how we put people into development so it can maximize its success. Discussions about the development began in August of 2022. There were informal talks about how the development could benefit the city, and concepts were shared with the Gilbert City Council. Jensen credited the city of Gilbert and its efforts to partner on the project. The city created an urban revitalization area and offered incentives to help him recoup some of the cost of development, including road and sewer. An official groundbreaking ceremony was held on March 1st. Jensen said dirt work is underway and the infrastructure should be in place this summer, with buildable lots being available by fall. Jensen said the development will complement the growth that is already underway in the community of about 1,300 people, which is located about 8 miles north of Ames. Gilbert's population is growing at about 2% a year and is up nearly 9% since the 2020 census. Much of the community's growth has revolved around residential and the school district, Jensen said. It's that growth that has sparked the need for more commercial growth in the city. When I graduated high school, there were 80 kids in my class, said Jensen, who has three children in the Gilbert School District. Today, I think it's around 130 kids. So there's a lot more activity in the area. His vision would be to have businesses included in the development, like a coffee shop or bakery, as a gathering spot for the community. I'm more aware of it now on the other side of life. When I was in high school, I didn't care, said Jensen, a 2002 graduate of Gilbert High School. We went down to Casey's on the corner, and now being around the community more and being connected in deeper ways, there's a desire to create space that people want to be in. The U.S. Small Business Administration, SBA, will recognize National Small Business Week the week of April 28th to May 4th. On April 30th and May 1st, the SBA will hold the 2024 National Small Business Week Virtual Summit, which is now open for registration. The two-day online event will feature educational workshops, access to federal resources, and networking opportunities. A detailed agenda and list of speakers will be published at a later date. Attendance is free, but registration is required. The SBA will also honor National Small Business Week 2024 award winners on April 28th and 29th in Washington, D.C. This year's Iowa Small Business Person of the Year is Kathy Bishop, president of Aggies Incorporated, a catering company in Sergeant Bluff. Bishop started the company in 1994 as a restaurant and pivoted to catering full-time in 2009. The Iowa Association of Business and Industry Foundation announced that the deadline to nominate community leaders for Leadership Iowa's 2024-2025 class is April 1st. 40 Iowans from a diverse range of industries, professions, and backgrounds will be selected to participate in the Issues Awareness Program, which runs from October to June and provides class members with resources to tackle the challenges facing Iowa, according to a news release. The group observes 8, 2, or 3-day monthly sessions throughout the state. More than 1,400 Iowans have graduated from Leadership Iowa in its 42 years. Self-nominations are allowed and encouraged. To nominate individuals and learn more about the program, you can visit the Association of Business and Industry Foundation website. Iowa makes a short list of states in consideration for bioindustrial manufacturing pilot facility. Minnesota-based nonprofit BioMade seeks to build national facility network to help U.S. companies scale domestically. This is an article written by Sarah Dean of the Business Record. Iowa is on a short list of 6 states being considered for potential locations as part of a national network of bioindustrial manufacturing pilot facilities, which would represent a minimum $25 million investment for Iowa if selected, according to a March 13th announcement from Bioindustrial Manufacturing Design Ecosystem. And their acronym is BioMade. BioMade is a nonprofit created by the Engineering Biology Research Consortium. In 2020, the organization received an $87 million 7-year award from the U.S. Department of Defense and was named a Bioindustrial Manufacturing Innovation Institute to work with public and private entities to advance bioindustrial manufacturing technologies. Bioindustrial manufacturing uses biology to convert agriculture feedstocks and waste streams to high-value chemicals, materials, and other defense and industrial-based products. It can create products like cement, fire-resistant materials, durable fibers, bioplastics, and food products. In response to questions regarding possible discussions with BioMade, an Iowa Economic Development Authority spokesperson declined to comment on whether the agency is in talks with the organization because negotiations on an application that may or may not be made under discussion are treated as confidential until projects are approved by the Iowa Economic Development Authority Board. However, the agency shared the following statement with the Business Record on the effect a biomanufacturing facility would have on the state of Iowa if selected for the project. And that statement reads as this: many of the industrial facilities around the state that currently produce food and fuel products from corn, soybeans, and other renewable products also produce certain co-products that can be processed into higher-value basic chemical compounds. These compounds can be further processed into end-use consumer products, the statement said, and it went on to add, the extensive work in renewable chemicals derived from agricultural byproducts that take place every day through the state's research institutions and numerous companies already demonstrates the investment and importance of this industry to our economy and ultimately makes Iowa an attractive place for companies in this sector to do business. The establishment of additional bioprocessing facilities in our state further cements our preeminence in the bioscience in manufacturing sectors and positions Iowa as a hub for innovation. According to the announcement, BioMADE's proposed facilities network would help address a gap in domestic pilot and intermediate scale bioindustrial manufacturing infrastructure by providing American companies space to scale products and technologies from the laboratory to commercial production domestically. BioMADE is working to build a domestic end-to-end bioindustrial manufacturing ecosystem that would retain American research and development efforts to secure a domestic supply chain and resupply U.S. manufacturing jobs, the news release said. The other states under consideration for a pilot facility are California, Georgia, Hawaii, Indiana, and North Carolina. You're listening to this week's edition, March 22nd, 2024 edition of the Business Record. Our thanks to the folks at Business Publications for providing a copy of the Business Record to IRIS, so that we can read it for you. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now back to the Business Record. Registration is now open for the Iowa Bicycle Coalition's ride series occurring in May and June to help local cyclists prepare for Ragbri, the Pigtails Ride, the Bay Coon Ride, and the Big Rove Ride. Are hosted by the coalition occur on some of Iowa's favorite trails. These family-friendly events include food, drinks, and fun. Early bird pricing is available until April 1st when prices increase, according to a press release. Matt Phippen, Ragbri Rag Director, in a prepared statement said that Ragbri will be here before you know it. Weather this spring has given us plenty of opportunities to get out and ride, he added. Jonathan Gruber, chair of the Economics Department at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, will be presenting as part of the Tippey College of Business's Toll Lecture in Economics at 5:30 p.m. in March 29th. Gruber, who is one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act, will explore the history of U.S. health care policy and its implications for the future in a lecture entitled Healthcare Reform Never Ends. Gruber will discuss how we got to where we are in healthcare policy and the central issues facing the United States in the coming decade, especially in rural areas. This is a free event, and the following when there will be a reception following, which will be open to the public. And our next article is two questions with Jeff Wood on expanding the Gravitate co-working. Sarah Dean of the Business Record wrote this article. When businesses were shuttered during the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, Jeff Wood, founder of Gravitate Coworking, said co-working as a model felt in danger because people weren't sharing spaces or socializing. I 100% was not sure that this was going to survive the initial pandemic because all the federal health policy that we were reading was saying to not do the things that we specialize in, Wood said. But businesses picked up in the following years as vaccines came out and hybrid and remote work became common for more people than ever. In a recent interview with Wood, he reflected on 10 years in business, including how Gravitate is looking to expand its presence further into the Des Moines suburbs. More suburban co-working spaces are popping up, in part because hybrid workers are interested in working close to where they live. Industrious, a co-working space provider with more than 160 locations worldwide, is now launching 70% of new locations outside of central business districts, and that's up from 30% before the pandemic. While Gravitate is looking to grow, Wood said he will be patient in finding the right spaces. We have a pretty specific formula that we think works for us, and we're slow to jump on new locations, he said. Gravitate has one suburban location in Windsor Heights, along with its two in downtown Des Moines, and its only space outside the metro area is in Jefferson. An excerpt of the interview with Woods is below, His responses have been lightly edited for clarity and length. So the first question that Sarah posed to Jeff is this one. What is Gravitate looking for when scouting potential new locations? His response, we tried to be above 10,000 square feet, which is pretty big for the state of Iowa market-wise. Nationally, it's kind of small, but when we look at some of the other co-working spaces that have been successful around the state, they're not 10,000 square feet. We know that number works really well because we generate revenue based on space. It's not a direct calculation. I think brokers and landlords always ask, well, how much can you pay? It depends on what we put in the space. It's very different than the way most companies come in and say, I need 50 chairs. We need to be able to look at the design. We'd like to be further out in the suburb because I think the downtown market, we're really comfortable with our offerings here, the two locations, East Village and Central Business District downtown. Finding a space that's 10,000 square feet in the suburbs is somewhat tricky just because we haven't built out the office element of the suburbs, and a lot of the spaces that we looked at that are that big have pretty high dollar amounts. One way to think of this is like office space as a service. We can't necessarily put that big of a premium to get into some of these spaces out there. One of the things we're always interested in sublease opportunities in second generation spaces. If somebody's already done the hard work of putting in the bathrooms and walls, we'll try to fit around that. That's better for us than a blank box that we have to build everything from the ground just because that initial cost is a lot for us to absorb. Next question is, is the interest in the suburbs in part driven by post-pandemic shifts in how people work? Jeff's response to that question is this. Absolutely. We think our market will grow a lot based on people in the suburbs that want to kind of come to something local. If they've taken a remote job and don't want to come downtown anymore, they're probably not going to come downtown to Gravitate if they live in Ankeny or Waukee or farther out than that. So if we are in Ankeny and Waukee, I think we have a lot of chances to bring those people in and provide them the hospitality and value that we bring. But it's one of those things. Are you going to drive across town to go to a coffee shop if you've got one in your neighborhood? No, you're more likely to go to that neighborhood one or just make coffee at home. We want to be that neighborhood co-working space for people. And again, this was a column written by Sarah Dean, who's the digital news editor and staff writer at the Business Record. And a new plan outlines community-wide effort for tackling food insecurity in central Iowa. This is a story written by Kyle Heim of the Business Record. A new Central Iowa food security plan calls the entire community to the table to tackle the growing challenge of food insecurity in the area. The plan, which United Way of Central Iowa and the Community Foundation Greater Des Moines provided funding support for, and unveiled during an event, calls for a united, collaborative response that aims to address food insecurity equitably, respectfully, and with dignity. Scott Raker, Executive Director of the Robert D. and Billy Ray Center at Drake University, who facilitated the plan along with Jordan Vernoy of See What I Mean Consulting, said that while he believes previous efforts have done well over time in trying to meet the short-term needs of the hungry population, that need has grown. Raker said, the Central Iowa Food Security Plan addresses that. It addresses how do we feed the hungry neighbor today and tomorrow, but it also has a longer-term look of how do we reduce that need and build a system long-term to meet whatever needs still exist. There are two longer-term pieces, and I think that makes us different because a lot of times what communities go after, what organizations go after is, and rightfully so, we've got to meet that short-term need. We've got hungry people. What do we do today to meet the need? And I'm so busy doing that, as we heard from the Urbandale Pantry, I don't even have time to, one, get to know the people, but two, to sit down and strategically plan and think of how we make sure a family doesn't have to come again. Data gathered for the plan shows that in central Iowa, including Polk, Dallas, and Warren counties, 6.8% of the population faces food insecurity, while the rate for children is 8.9%. The plan offers four goals for tackling the issue. One, offer a welcoming and dignified experience for neighbors in need of food and services through an accessible and connected network of providers. Two, develop, advocate, and implement policy solutions that are informed by data and voices of people with lived experience to improve the quality of life for neighbors facing food insecurity. 3, tell the story of food insecurity in Central Iowa through an intentional, collaborative, and equitable data collection process to better inform services, design, and decision-making. And finally, grow stronger together by honoring our neighbors' lived experience and building a collaborative and connected community. To measure the progress of the plan, Racker said that the first step will be identifying who is going to measure it. One of the critical elements of this is the ownership. The Opportunity Food Insecurity Workgroup has been tasked with accountability. Now it's collective accountability. So all of the people on the panel during the event and others, Mid-Iowa Health Foundation, Des Moines Area Religious Council, and Food Bank of Iowa has a lot of data, and we will use their data to see if we're moving numbers. There are some big rock numbers you can look at, like has the need gone down, or in fact, I think you might see the need go up, because if one of the things we do is communicate with people where the resources are and they have access to them, I actually think you could potentially see the needs go up even more before it plateau and come down. Whether that be the number of our site visits, pounds of food distributed, those are all metrics we'll have that we can use that will paint part of the picture. Another of the key measurements will be whether there's active engagement from all sectors, public, private, nonprofit, and the entire community. You also have the first grader that hears about the need and mobilizes the other first graders, and they all bring in 3 cans of food, Raker said. If every school in the state, in the county, in Central Iowa was doing that, we would help meet that need. Luke Lynch, Senior Community Engagement Officer for United Way of Central Iowa, said as the plan moves forward, the work group will help set the metrics, determine what's realistic, and decide how to get there. Lynch said, when collecting data from neighbors living in food insecurity, we don't want it to be detrimental to the services they're receiving, but also not to let perfect be the enemy of good. We've got to move forward. We can't just sit around and wait to move. The metrics may change as we learn more, as there's more usage in the community. If one of our goals is to drive down the number of usage in pantries, not to say that that's what it would be, if we find out that it ends up going up, that's a story that we can all tell and we can all understand and make sure the community knows that as well. The community piece is so important, said Lynch. Leaders starting weekly meetings to chart a path forward on the Tyson closure. The Greater Dallas County Development Alliance hosted a meeting of local, state, and federal leaders to discuss concerns and challenges following Tyson's food announcement that it will close the Perry plant and lay off more than 1,200 workers in June. According to a press release, the meeting was the first of what is anticipated to be a weekly discussion to chart a path forward in supporting affected workers and mitigating the impact of the community. The closure of Tyson Foods has undoubtedly created uncertainty and will likely create hardships for many individuals and families. And that's a statement by Perry City Administrator Sven Peterson. However, in the face of adversity, our community has demonstrated resilience and solidarity. On the heels of the tragedy experienced in January, today's meeting underscored our collective commitment to finding solutions and providing support to Perry's citizens. We implore the executive leadership at Tyson to stick to their word and find a user for the soon-to-be-vacated facility. In future meetings, stakeholders will continue to collaborate to address immediate needs and develop long-term strategies for economic recovery and job creation. The release said that efforts will be made to ensure that affected workers have access to essential services, including job training and application services, healthcare, interpretation services, food security, and financial resources. For more information or to inquire about support services available to affected individuals, an email can be sent to the info@dallascounty-iowa.org. The following organizations were represented at the meeting in addition to Iowa Economic Development Authority Director Debbie Durham: Iowa Economic Development Authority, as we mentioned, Iowa Workforce Development, the Office of Congressman Zach Nunn, the Greater Dallas County Development Alliance, the City of Perry, Perry Economic Development, Perry Community School District, the Perry Chamber of Commerce, Dallas County Hospital, DMAC, Alliant Energy, MidAmerican Energy, Minburn Communications, the Iowa Area Development Group, Osmundson Manufacturing, Progressive Foundry, and Raccoon Valley Bank. The Iowa Women's Foundation distributes $190,000 in 2024 grant funding. The Iowa Women's Foundation announced grant funds to 13 organizations from across Iowa as part of the foundation's longstanding mission to improve the lives of Iowa women and girls by funding programs to address evidence-based barriers to their economic self-sufficiency. Awards were given at several events throughout the state. Grantees are organizations working to address one of the six primary barriers to economic self-sufficiency for women and girls, with programs in all stages of planning and development. The Iowa Women's Foundation awarded 8 core grants totaling $150,000 and 5 community child care solutions grants that totaled $40,000. The 2024 core grant recipients include Dorothy's House in Central Iowa, Eyes Open Iowa, which is statewide, Girls on the Run Eastern Iowa, that's in Eastern Iowa, the House of Hope in Cedar Valley, IJAG, which is a statewide organization, St. Mark Youth Enrichment in Dubuque, the Kids Spot in Lake City, and the Young Women's Resource Center in Central Iowa. The 2024 CCCS grant recipients include Hawkeye Community College Foundation in Cedar Valley, Little Vikes Child Care in Avoca, Little Charger Early Learning Center in Guthrie Center, the Little Knights Learning Center in LaPorte City, and the Wayland Area Child Care Organization in Wayland, Iowa. The UFG Foundation has allocated $296,000 in its latest funding cycle to support 20 nonprofit projects in Iowa. The organization is a private foundation of UFG Insurance, a property and casualty insurance carrier. Recipients of the grants in this cycle include organizations such as Bruce Moore, the Cedar Rapids Public Library, and the Girl Scouts of Eastern Iowa. The foundation has historically prioritized funding for health and human services, arts, education, environmental programs, contributing over $15 million to nonprofits since its inception in 1999. And another column or a feature of the business record is People on the Move. It's just a listing of people who have moved into new positions. So we'll take a look at this week's edition. Doug Parker at Twin Cedars Bank has been hired as a Vice President, Senior Business and Wealth Banker. Rebecca Queensland of Lampson, Duggan, and Murray LLP, she's been hired there as an attorney. Abby Allen of Bank Iowa has been hired as a branch manager in Altoona. Doug Williams at Indigo Living, he's been hired as a Service Technician 1. Brian McCulhey of Hubble Construction Services, been hired there as a Senior Construction Project Manager. Melissa Ganson at Hubble Realty has been hired as an accounting specialist. Also at Hubble, Mateo Duran has been hired as a new home sales professional. At Indigo Living, Justice McAbee, Service Tech 1. Also at Indigo Living, Ishmael Mohammed has been hired as assistant property manager. Also at Indigo Living, Walter Lewis has been hired as a Service Tech 1. At the Des Moines Area Regional Transit Authority, often called DART, Diane Washburn has been hired there as their chief financial officer. And we'll turn now to another opinion piece from the Business Record. This is written by Susanna DeBaca, and it's titled On Leadership, Leadership Lessons from Brigadier General. And Susanna writes, on a recent flight home from a business trip, I was pleasantly surprised to find myself seated next to a friend from our school days at Ballard Huxley, retired Brigadier General David Elwell. Throughout junior high and high school, Elwell, or David as I referred to him back then, he and I were in many activities together. Most notably, we both played saxophone and were seated by each other in concert and jazz band for many years. While I was familiar with his impressive career as a military officer and had run into him a few times in Des Moines, we had not been in touch, so I was delighted to have the opportunity to catch up with him. For the first part of our flight, we reminisced about our years at Ballard, recalling teachers and classmates, parties, school activities, and class trips. Our conversation soon turned to our personal and professional lives. I was so intrigued by his leadership experience in the military that I asked if he would be open to an interview for this column. As a Business Record reader, he readily agreed, and his insights are particularly relevant for any business executive trying to lead and execute in today's rapidly changing and volatile world. Elwell grew up on a farm near Slater, Iowa. After graduating from Ballard High School, he enrolled at Drake University. During his freshman year, his father passed away. He joined ROTC to help pay for college and was subsequently commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Army Transportation Corps. Through his more than 35 years of active and reserve service, Elwell commanded at every level from platoon to sustainment command, including battalion command in Afghanistan, where he supported Operation Enduring Freedom. In addition to tours of duty in Afghanistan and Iraq, he served across the world and the U.S. He retired in June of 2020. During his military career, he started and maintained a financial advisory practice, and today is the owner and president of Elwell Financial Incorporated and of Benjamin Companies and JPA Family Corp. The acronym VUCA, Volatile, Uncertain, Complex, Ambiguous, originated with students in the U.S. Army War College to illustrate the volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity of our world after the Cold War. Since that term is now widely used in the business world, I asked Elwell how he addressed environments that could be described as volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. He explained that how to plan for situations that are unknown or how to predict the results of your actions when you don't really even know what your actions will be. He said the Army has a saying, the plan isn't as important as the planning. He explained that the military recognizes most plans don't survive first contact, so what is important is understanding the variables of a plan so that you can adjust as quickly as needed. Elwood noted that the Army has a formal decision-making process that officers learn early in their career. It helps the organization see their own strengths and weaknesses as well as those of the enemy. When you see all the interrelated variables, you can more deeply understand the longer-term effects and unintended consequences of your actions. A key part of the planning decision-making process is contingency planning. He noted that this part of the process is so detailed that there are contingency plans for the contingency plans, the idea being that the very process of scenario planning helps leaders to think through many alternative courses of action as possible. In a volatile environment, these contingency plans help leaders identify what is known, what is unknown, and what they can assume based on knowledge and experience, said Elwell. All of this gathering of intelligence is in place so that you have as much information as possible to make the situation less ambiguous. Susanna asked Elwell what was the most important preparation he had for leading in combat environments. He reflected that the first 20 years of his career were in a peacetime environment. When he was finally sent into combat in 2003, he felt well prepared as he'd had two decades of peacetime activities that were similar to the activity in wartime. All his training was preparation for combat. Elwell said, in a combat environment, what prepares you most is actually the preparation. While that might sound like a funny response, there are years of training, protocols, and expectations. There is practical leadership, formal schooling, lots of institutional education. Even when I became a general, I had more formal schooling. The training along the way included rising in the ranks from tactical roles to operational roles and finally to strategic roles. There was a combination of formal experience, school, mentoring, training, and constant feedback. You are not put in a situation you are not ready for, he said. Before you've been in a role, you've supported the role. He continued, in the Army we have a saying, we train as we fight. DeBaca asked Elwell how his leadership style changed when he was in combat environments. He was especially thoughtful about this question, noting that leadership in combat was different, but maybe not in the way one would think. He pointed out that the biggest difference was that in combat, the mission is real. In training, everyone knows their training and the realities of daily life, families or careers that have been put on hold, are valid distractions that a leader must manage. But in combat, people are away from their homes and families and are now in life and death situations. The environment was different, so the leadership needs shifted. It was actually easier to command and combat, he said, because everything was 100% focused on the mission. When asked about what lessons from the battlefield were most relevant, Elwell did not hesitate, saying, "Everything is about having the right team. All the times I've had the most success is when I assemble the best people into the best team. Team members must be proficient in their areas of expertise. If team members or leaders do not have that expertise, they must have the skill set or work ethic to grow into it. But if those conditions do not exist, you cannot put or keep that person in that role. It would jeopardize the mission." Because his roles involved danger and extreme stress, I asked Elwell what was satisfied about being a commander. In addition to the gratification of knowing he was helping protect our nation, he said he enjoyed having responsibility at a strategic level. "I enjoyed making decisions that had an impact on the mission, on the team, on their living conditions, all of it fit together." At the strategic level of a commander, he noted, he had the opportunity to truly make a difference for groups and individuals. When you can see that you're adding to the health of any institution, that is something you can really feel good about. And that, again, was an article or a column written by Susanna DeBacca on leadership and interviewed General Elwell for that article. Well, you've been listening to The Business Record on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. I'm Pat Steele, and it's been my pleasure to read for you, and thank you for sharing your time with IRIS.